You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, The Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding, Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is part two, which is a training course for Upper Salesians. The first lecture in it is titled Lecture 1 in the book, but here it is Lecture 11 in our collection, given in Stuttgart on January 1st, 1921. The inspiration for our Congress here is connected with an idea that has been discussed for a long time by the Association for the Threefold Social Organism. Actually, it would be necessary for us to prepare comprehensively, meaning in a longer period of instruction and discussion, for activism on behalf of the threefold social organism. From April 1919 onward, the threefolding movement was supposed to have an effect more quickly than it has proved to do. And therefore, at the beginning of the year recently past, I was already emphasizing the necessity of taking up activism on behalf of the Association for Threefolding, not through some sort of formal examination of the art of speaking or the like, but through a deeply felt understanding of the urgency with which something like the threefolding movement must be handled in this our most dire and fevered moment. All around us, of course, we see all manner of political, social, or other kinds of activism happening. And everywhere you look, you see how the whole way in which these actions are conducted is essentially a kind of dying out. In the most recent period, we have had the most gloomy experiences of this in the way that people, whenever something is to be communicated from the perspective of present-day life, are thinking about and staging things that are necessary for the further development of one relationship or another. We saw it at the League of Nations meeting in Geneva, where everything that is important today was merely talked about in passing, where people did not actually go into any of the issues in question, and about which you could say that the only ones who actually managed things in such a way that their actions had legs were the ones who left, the Argentinians. Now, I said that our threefolding movement had been predicted to make greater progress than it actually has. This, of course, is connected with the fact that in our current era, in which there is never enough time, it is not possible to conduct such a movement with a slow tempo, because otherwise the possibility of bringing something about that will lead to healing within Europe and Central Europe in particular will disappear. It is therefore necessary that we be clear that we are heading with great alacrity toward downfall, even if sometimes one or two find a way of slipping out of it. And so, above all, we must come to understand what the necessary conditions are for an agitation, or whatever one wants to call it. And we will do this now by way of a concrete question. You see, I said that our discussions have emerged from an idea. The idea was that around 50 individuals would gather here with the purpose of gaining an understanding of the methods, and more especially the foundations of such an agitation. For unless agitations are conducted in a drastic and widespread manner, and soon, we will never get anywhere with something as comprehensive as the threefolding of society must be. Standing before you right now is a vote that will affect the fate of Upper Silesia. We can discuss something of what actually must happen with all intensity in the near future. We can discuss this only generally in the few days that are granted to us for this particular question. First, what is necessary now is the conviction that we cannot link any of the things that will actually bring civilization to salvation to the old configurations of public life. You cannot, if you hope to be effective, say this to the public in the words that I will speak now. But you must have this in the background when choosing your words, when choosing the materials that you will present. You must be convinced of the fact that the question, quote, could we perhaps make a compromise with this political party, with this professional organization, or something like that, by allowing them to continue with their usual way of thinking, close quote, that all such questions should be answered with a definitive no. When the Anthroposophical Society was beginning its work, I would always hear things like this from all sides. Well, quote, well, this is how people in Munich are, and you have to deal with things a certain way. In Berlin, people are this way, and you have to do everything like this. In Hanover and other places, you have to handle things differently. Close quote. All of this is nonsense. It really is meaningless. The only thing that has any meaning is that we be clear about what must be newly created and formed, and that we have the will to bring these newly formed things to people, that we make ourselves understand how possible it is to achieve these new forms, not only in our intellectual understanding, but also in our feelings. I would like to characterize the second condition as follows. We need to have substance in our agitation, true content. During the last several centuries, when people did political or social or other forms of work, what did they work with? They worked with catchphrases, with turns of phrases. And the name that they invented for this kind of speech was, in quotes, ideals. In their heads, they were working with ideals. Now, with ideals, if what is hidden there in that word is precisely what was meant by it in the 19th and 20th centuries, with ideals, it is possible to make a momentary impression on people's feelings and perceptions, to excite them, to make them jump around and make all sorts of crazy gestures. But you cannot achieve any sort of real results with this excitement that is built on empty words. And achieving results is really what is important now. We can achieve results only if we say, quote, we are living today in a kind of societal ordering wherein our downfall itself is threefolded, close quote. The downfall is threefolded. And the disorganized division, I cannot say organized, of this downfall shows itself in the most crucial places. We are witnessing a downfall of our spiritual life that expresses itself finally within the various religious confessions, on the one hand, and in our schools on the other, which do not even know where to blow their smoke as they burn. These two things in our spiritual life, the church and the schools, are one aspect of our downfall. They are connected in the most intimate way with a further aspect of the downfall, which essentially feeds the life of the churches and schools. They are connected with the principle of nationalism. Everywhere, those things that people are trying to bring into our schools, those things that live in the schools, reach up from the foundations of the nation. And, on the other hand, all of the various confessions in the most diverse territories of the world, even if they try to be international, direct themselves specifically toward the nation. A further aspect is the Right's political realm, which is everywhere sailing toward its downfall. The important thing there is that people are finally leaving behind, we might already say, every damaging cover-up of the relationships that, at least in the central regions of Europe, have continued on out of old customs. But such a situation must be seen, at least distinctly enough, that something clear emerges from it. Today, people do not have any idea of how corrupt the political life of modern civilization had actually become before it brought about the catastrophe of 1914. You see, many examples of this can be offered. Let us look at one of them. Within Germany and the bordering territories, there are still today a number of people who, as you might perhaps know, do not see that a certain individual with the name of Helferich was a destructive vermin in every place that he ever did anything. For example, You need only to remember that shortly before the outbreak of war, this individual, Helfferich, gave a speech in which he said, quote, "What some people are claiming, that Germany could starve if a war came, that seems to me little more than a theory. For if such a war were to break out, then so many different powers would be involved that you would have to have a pretty big distrust of German diplomacy to believe that everyone would be against us. But such distrust is beyond my ability to comprehend." Close quote. This is more or less what Helfferich said shortly before the outbreak of war in 1914. Now, there is so much intellectual ignominy in this. I say ignominy because it is simultaneously intellectual and moral, that it is precisely things like this that must, when we look hard at them, make clear to us the level of corruption at which modern civilization finds itself. Just think of all that is really said in these words from Helfferich. Quote, "If the thing that so many people are predicting comes about, that Germany would be blockaded from all sides if a war were to come, then one can have no trust in German diplomacy. But we must have precisely that trust." Close quote. Just think, a man like him says that we must have this trust. This means that sand must be thrown in people's eyes, because he was aware that this trust is impossible. Today you must be clear with yourself that if you intend to go on working with unreality, you cannot make any sort of progress. Even words like radical and not radical have more or less lost their value, because it is now a matter of speaking about certain things more radically than was done before. Above all, it is important that you present to people concretely what leads to the detriment of humanity. We must arrive at very keen characterizations, not only of the currently existing relations, but also of the individuals. Only then can we really have any sort of lasting effect. And if we then consider such a question as the question of the Upper Silesian vote from this perspective, then we will have to be seized by an idea, by the thought, quote, "How should one relate to the vote itself, German or Polish?" This is the first question that presents itself, German or Polish, close quote. In this time, we must actually bring ourselves to consider such questions also from a certain objective, human-oriented perspective, not from a perspective that simply comes out of old ways of thinking, even if they are those that we call nationalistic. Such questions must be considered from an objective, human-oriented standpoint. And within the masses wherein this happens, within those masses, we will make progress. And to that end, as much as it is possible in this short period of time that can be dedicated to our understanding, I would like to demonstrate to you particular things from which one can call up the reasons for the conviction that from an objective human standpoint, both answers, German and Polish, result in an equally great misfortune, a great misfortune for the population of Upper Silesia, a great misfortune for Poland, a great misfortune for Germany, a great misfortune for Europe, a great misfortune for the entire world. I would like to show you that objectively the question German or Polish cannot actually exist for the Upper Silesian population, and that it is a matter of seeing that for this small population complex, we are actually dealing with a life question that requires us to arrive at a means of judgment such as the one provided by the threefold social organism. That is, to rise above everything that up until now has been offered up as a means of assessment. You see, when such questions are posed, we must be able to have a deep-seated feeling that in every undertaking, socially, politically, and economically, laws are at work, and that these things are not ruled by arbitrariness, but that these laws in turn become actualized, so that in a vote we can go about things only in a way allowed to us by law. We can discuss and vote on whether a furnace door should be affixed to this or that side of an oven, and we would do well, when it comes to such questions, to consult with people who know something about it. but we cannot have a vote once we have put wood into the furnace. On whether that wood can be lit only with a match, or rather with a piece of ice. You see, questions of the application of will must be brought into a proper relationship with the demands of life. This is why you cannot just speak from the separate realm of the will, from nebulousness and indeterminacy, and also why you cannot arrange to have a small population exposed in the world to vote on its own fate. Now, when everything still comes from old systems of thinking, we might shy away from saying publicly that this will lead most certainly toward downfall. We might be afraid to say precisely what is right to people, because it would seem to be absurd to them. But this is exactly what is important, saying to people what is right. If you want to speak about this question, then you must truly speak, from a starting point that also affords a view of the powers that really have an effect. In the study of the Polish character, you can observe very well how utterly impossible it would be to simply declare that such an exposed territory be incorporated into the Polish region. And if you consider the relationship of the Upper Silesian territory to the Polish region, then already the other relationships crop up. The relationship to the Prussian-German region. It does not suffice to judge the character of the Polish population and its place within European politics on the basis of a very few observations that you have made of this or that Pole, nor will it work to consider things on the basis of how one or another series of events coming out of Poland has been taken up in history. None of that suffices. Instead, you must make clear to yourself what sort of special role the Polish population has played within an ever-expanding European territory. This role that the Polish population has played is at a basic level very characteristic for the development of other political relationships within Europe. And the Polish factor plays very, very heavily into European political relationships. If you consider Poland, you see that from a cultural, political perspective, it is so fundamentally exposed to both Western and Eastern influences. And it shows such inner peculiarities, this Polish population, that you can really say, quote, what the disposition was of people elsewhere since the 15th and 16th centuries has found clear expression in the Polish population. Close quote. We cannot consider Poland except to see how, on the one hand, the cultural, political, and spiritual traditions of the East can be found in the Eastern regions, and how, now, even though Poland has experienced all manner of fates, the modern Russian character has gradually moved in. We cannot assess Poland without taking into consideration the way that in its southern regions, coming out of relationships from the Middle Ages, the Austrian Empire, now on the brink of collapse, is preparing for its own disintegration, and also the way that, finally, in the West, the German Empire formed, though destined for a short existence. You see, what lives within the European life of Poland is actually connected with all of these things. If you look at the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 16th century, relationships appear in the German regions that actually did not find any sort of direct continuation. You need only to remember names like Götz von Berlichingen, Franz von Sickingen, Ulrich von Hutten, and so on. And you can see certain relationships that existed then, but then did not find any sort of continuation. What were these relationships built on? There was a feudal caste there. A feudal caste that understandably was able to produce such strong and, in a certain sense, remarkable people as the ones I have named. But this feudal caste was built upon an ignorant, more or less uncivilized mass of peasants. And the fact that this feudal caste worked in such a way that the great lords always lived among the others, who were ignorant peasants, and that these lords also were the active practitioners of the administration, and, also, fundamentally ruled over the spiritual life. This is what gave the social life in Central Europe its structure. But right around the end of the 15th and beginning of the 16th century, this structure was abolished in Central Europe. It was abolished in such a way that one can say that within the German-speaking regions, the underlying sense of this structure had rotted through and through. And in place of this structure stepped something that had been initially worked through in the territorial princedoms, now gathered together into the German Empire, that is, the military and bureaucratic organization of the social organism. And so, out of the feudal, aristocratic element, which could be built up only on the broad foundations of an uncivilized peasantry, territorial princedoms expanded with militaristic and bureaucratic foundations. Within this, Central Europe, most especially in Prussia, this became the ethos. It did not become something that was merely imposed upon the social order. It became the ethos. Here, is it not the case that we can perhaps think about two opposites? One would be a man positioned within the old knightly Götz von Berlichingen society, who keeps himself busy with something or another. How does he busy himself? He busies himself, for example, by using his knowledge to arrange things, by setting up schools on the basis of what his religious world pictures provide, by thinking about how one speaks of proper human understanding to a particular parish that is not so large. Into the 16th century, this is how things were organized in regions that spoke German. Then such things were reorganized. Then came bureaucracy and the military. And if we think of the one person who could not have existed in the Götz von Berlichingen society, we would think of the lieutenant of the Prussian reserve. So, the possibility for the existence of such a soul is created only after the start of the 16th century. And is it not the case that the reserve lieutenant is a combination of bureaucratic and military existence? This came into being in Central Europe, not only in the regions where it could be understood, but also in regions where it could not be understood. Our history, for example, is written in such a way that this ethos is alive within it, and our history is taught in school in such a way that this ethos lies within it. But because of the fact that due to the character of the German population, this transformation could not take hold in the deepest, the most inner parts of the soul, because of this fact, territorial princedoms came into being, and not a full kaiserdom. That was attempted for the first time in the 19th century during the war in the 1870s, but was not able to succeed. Because of the most disparate historical relationships, the full elaboration of which would be too much for this occasion, a great wave swept everything toward the state, toward the rights political, and led to the imprisonment of the economic life within the political element. A great wave swept over Central Europe, and it is because of this that Central Europe is the way it is. Now, if you take a look at Russia, there you have, in the social structure, what was suddenly created in Central Europe at the beginning of the 16th century. You have a widespread, uneducated, uncivilized peasantry that is somehow supposed to be regulated, that is, somehow supposed to be incorporated into a social organism. The situation at hand is just the same as it was in Central Europe when it moved into the 16th century. But in Russia, the solution in individualism was not to be found. In Russia, everything was being very quickly incorporated into Tsarist centralization, so that the middle point that existed in Europe between Kaiserdom and the uncivilized masses was not there. Everything was moving in a direction wherein each person, regardless of whether suited to it or not, was being made into a bureaucrat or a military person, with the central authority giving the directives. In various ways, in Germany on the one hand, in Russia on the other, what was being annihilated was any sort of true Volksorganisation, any sort of organization of common humanity. On the one hand, it was being driven into Kaiserdom, and on the other hand, into territorial princedoms. And a third, then, is Austria. Austria, which grew up entirely out of patriarchal relationships, that lived on as a kind of family tradition within the lineage of princes. This Austria was being gradually compelled to bring together the most diverse populations under the auspices of Roman centralization, which wants to govern. It takes on a kind of democratic allure, but nevertheless wants to rule the populace in the manner of the Spanish Middle Ages. In the midst of these three streams you find the Polish factor, which is bracing itself fundamentally against all three of them, and which, I would like to suggest, has determined itself in a rather strange manner against all three streams out of a sort of inner position. The Polish factor does indeed take on all of those misleading elements from the West, parliamentarianism, the school system, and so on. I would say that it takes on all of those things that became a certain analytical, that become a certain analytical aspect of life, all that develops into the element of judgment, of discernment. From the East, it takes the element of synthesis, life in the form of big concepts and ideas. But you see, within the Polish factor, analysis becomes sloppiness, and the Eastern impulse toward synthesis turns toward fantasizing. These two elements are always definitely there, sloppiness from the Western stream, from ordered analysis, and from the Eastern stream the fantasizing and also the lack of truthfulness. This lack of truthfulness is just the shadow side of Eastern synthesis, and the sloppiness is just the shadow side of becoming pedantic. If pedantry goes so far that it becomes impossible to follow it, then it collapses into its opposite, into sloppiness. In Austria there was never a lack of penetrating regulations on all aspects of life. The essential point is that no single one of them could be followed. First of all, they all contradict each other, and second, there are so many that no one can really pay attention to all of them at once. How did it happen that this Polish being came about in Europe, when all around it was something entirely different? How did it happen that Poland continued tenaciously to develop its own nature? This happened because, as the great Russian wave, with its inherent plans for conquest, came crashing over Europe, it was necessary for the others who also came under consideration, I cannot describe all of this in detail, but one could do so, to react to this Russian being in the way described. Above all, it was necessary for the Prussian and the Austrian Empire in the 18th century to react to this Russian element. From a certain standpoint, it is easy to reproach the Prussians and the Austrians for dividing Poland with Russia. But when we do this, we forget that if they had not divided it, Russia would have simply taken it all for itself. You see, these things have to be considered objectively. Prussia and Austria took part in the division of Poland because they could not allow Russia to take over all of Poland itself, which surely would have happened otherwise. And so Poland was divided up. But within this divided population, that from which there had been a break in Europe in the German element at the beginning of the 16th century, the feudal nobility continued to live on, with its broad foundation in the uncivilized peasantry. That from which a similar break had been made, at least outwardly, in Russia, all of that continued to live on in Poland. The Polish being essentially preserved, let me read that again, the Polish being essentially preserved what had lived within the European social structure of the 15th century, which always had a kind of antique element in it, a Greek element within it. We marvel at Greece, but the greatness of Greece is due to the fact that it was the most highly developed of what we say was taken over by Europe in the 15th century. If we were to be clear about it, we must realize that we marvel at Greece rightly when looking at what history has made of it. And, on the other hand, we can also realize that we took a tremendous step forward when the effort was made to overcome gradually what could only be built on the basis of a rural proletariat. The evolution of Europe into the 15th century was still oriented toward Greece. We can say of this, in quotes, Greek Europe, that it is something that does not provide for any truly human state of being. A certain upper class, the one that was dominant in Poland, this upper class retained this Greek ethos, that is, the ethos of living within an upper class of nobility, with a simple, uncivilized peasantry beneath it, and not one differentiated into bourgeoisie and proletariat. And such was its disposition, this Polish population, when it was divided up. For is it not the case that those within this upper class were the only ones doing any thinking, any true thinking, in Poland? They began to hate Russia, Prussia, and Austria. But then, within this Polish aspect, there were these people upon whom nothing really depended, precisely this whole uncivilized lower class, with no political or other kind of intelligence. And you see, some of them went to Russia, some to Austria. In Russia they went where the Polish element was within Russian relationships, and in Austria, wherever the Polish element was within Galicia. And some of them came to Prussia, where the Polish element was in Silesia and Posen. The Polish class did not change, but simply acquitted itself within the existing relationships as well as it could, considering that it was completely ill-suited to them, particularly the political ones. In response to this, the lower class integrated itself in a most unusual manner. Of course, what has risen up from that lower class must be sought these days as a new fermentation, precisely as what has risen up from the lower class that was beneath the top layer of the Polish nobility. You see, it is curious that this lower class has actually retained a particular structure within the context of the relationships that emerged from the division of Poland. Because of the structure that existed in Russian Poland, this lower class has taken on a spiritual element in the most eminent sense, a spiritual element directed toward a deepening of thinking and a deepening of the sciences through a certain religious element. Up until the revolution, one did not distinguish between religious life and the scientific in Russia. Allowing spiritual thoughts, the perceptions of the sensory life to run freely through the big, comprehensive, synthetic ideas, is what has been brought over into the Polish element from the East by the Russian element. Without the influence of the spiritual side of social life, people like Slovaki and Dunajewski are, I believe, unimaginable. In contrast, the section of the Polish being that went over to Austria, where this lower class took from Austria the state's rights political, and this is why the most refined political minds and speakers, such as Hausner and Wolski, have come out of Austrian Galicia, essentially out of Poland. This people could never have come out of the Polish being if it had not been absorbed by the neighboring areas, where comprehensive synthetic ideas could be learned from Russia, and the necessary standpoint for constitutional political thinking from Austria. Such a man as Hausner, who played such a large role in the 1870s and 1880s, was an assemblyman in a Polish-Galician city. Such a figure and his parliamentary colleague Wolski, they are what we might call political minds, through and through. Not people who can necessarily rule, but who can see through these relationships in a wonderful manner. You see, this is what is being said everywhere now about political relationships, without there being any substance to the words. We must concern ourselves with what has happened. When considering the course for activists, I did not think that individuals would be instructed how to speak, but rather I thought that materials on activism should be distributed, and it is from this perspective that I am speaking now. Everything that happened in the year 1918, that has happened throughout the events since 1914, You could have prophesied it in the previous century, at the end of the 1870s, within the Austrian Parliament. It is true that at that time, such people as Hausner and Bolsky spoke about the downfall of Austria, about the inability to really confront the proletarian question, and other questions. In short, everything that had to be said was spoken about in the Austrian Parliament. The people then had just about all of it right, except for two things: the timing of it all, and the possibilities that exist in the present. As far as the timing goes, they saw things in all sorts of warped, fantastical ways. Take a man like Hausner. He once said very grandiosely in a speech that in the moment Austria marches into Bosnia, the ground is laid for collapse. The things that came about for others later, Hausner has already brought up in the 1870s. But he got the timing wrong. He thought that it would happen within 10 years. This is due to the influence of the Eastern element. It existed even in level-headed Hausner, the fantastic. He sees what is true, but his view on the timing is blurred. What still needed 2, 3, or 4 more decades to come about, he predicted would come in the next decade. And then Hausner once offered a critique of the Germans, with a complete misunderstanding at that time. You can read in the speech that he gave around 1880 that it was not suited to the relationships of that moment at all, but with a certain sensitive sort of grimness, he does describe the situation of our present moment. So these people make mistakes, but it is nevertheless the case that one can say that Poland has been particularly pushed by the East toward big, comprehensive thinking, and pushed by Austria toward the political state life, which was largely dominated by such people as Hausner and Volsky. And therefore we must also believe, this is absolutely true and shows itself to be so in reality, that the parts of Poland that came over into Prussia have received their particular stimulus toward a development of the economic life, and that this must become the fulcrum point for the dealings of those parts of civilization that came to Prussia from Poland, the handling of the economic life. Poland has been particularly endowed with economic life from Prussia, political life from Austria, and religious spiritual life from Russia. We have here a threefolding that demonstrates that the Polish people have been endowed by Russia with a gift for great spiritual ideas. If you study what is called Polish messianism, the writings of Slovaki, or even what it is that the Polish people talk about from day to day, you find that impulse comes out of the East. If, on the other hand, you study what lives in the Polish people, what they make of their politicians, leaving them basically alone in the plotting of conspiracies and the like, you will find that they get this from Austria, and you will find that they have their economic life from Prussia. But with all of this, it is not possible to build any sort of Poland, any sort of Polish state. Europe must also divide in such a way that a particular population takes something different from the Polish take, than the Polish take from Austria, namely the spiritual, and from Austria something different than the Polish take from Prussia, namely the political, and from Prussia the economic. This must come about through a great process of splitting up. The capacities of these three areas can certainly be achieved, but no unified state can come out of this. It might be constructed, but it will always collapse again. There will never in reality be a Poland for any extended period of time, because there can never be one. In the decisive moment, Poland must be divided so that the Polish people can fully develop their abilities. But there will never be a Poland, and to speak of Poland now is an illusion. We must do everything we can to bring to popular awareness such ideas, the seed of which I have just indicated to you in regard to the impossibility of such national structures, sought after in an attempt to construct a unified state. We have to bring into people's thinking and feeling the knowledge that we go barreling toward misfortune every time we speak about, quote, being Polish, close quote. We have to get away from Polish and move toward the universally human. For only the things that have developed historically into this threefolding will come to fruition. Take a look at these matters from the opposite side. The Poles received great comprehensive ideas from Russia. The Russians gave them these ideas. But Russia no longer has these ideas itself, for it has drifted into Bolshevism. The Russians were not strong enough to construct a social organism. They are living within a social organism that is moving completely toward devastation. Look at what was especially characteristic of Austria in the most notable parliament in the world during the 1870s, when there were men such as Hausner, Dunajewski, and others like them. For example, the old Czechs Rieger and Gregor as well, not to mention other people like Herbst, Planer, Carneri, who were Germans. Back then, you had the most eminent Czechs, the most eminent Poles, the most eminent Germans. Regarding the Germans, you had the same sort of situation as you did with the Poles. We see again how in the lower class among the Czechs, such men were formed into the most refined politicians by living within the context of Austrian relationships. And in Austria, people became fine politicians, arriving at a subtle understanding of political relationships. But this started with the Germans in Austria, and a person like Otto Hausner, with his subtle grasp of politics, with his accurate predictions of Austria's downfall, once said, quote, "If we continue to conduct our economics as we are currently, then in 5 years there will no longer be an Austrian parliament," close quote. He overstated this, of course. Only later did what he said come true, but it was an accurate prediction. People like this were made possible solely by the Germans in Austria, who actually took this form of parliamentarianism from the West and transplanted it in Central Europe through the schools. But the Germans in Austria are the ones from whom the others became familiar with this refined, subtle concept of political life. They themselves, however, conducted themselves within this concept as clumsily as possible. This is characteristic, that they should act clumsily. This is what others learn from them and what becomes important to the others. In the moment that it crosses over into the minds of the others, it becomes significant for European life as ferment. As a result, the Germans depended upon maintaining their hold on the territory in which they resided. They could not do this. The Poles did not have to maintain their hold on anything, because they did not have anything. They were thus able to develop the ideas as such. The Germans could not do anything with the ideas. They gave them to the others, and in so doing buried their own social organism. Now we come to the third element. In Germany, an economic life has truly developed. You could say that the economic life in Central European Germany has surpassed all the other developments of economic life in the world. Tremendous economic relationships have developed there. But they are growing up into thin air. They cannot support themselves. Poland could again learn a lot from them, but the Germans themselves cannot continue to practice economics in this way. They are steering themselves toward catastrophe. This would have been the case even if the war had not come. So again we see a threefolding of the European downfall, from the spiritual side in Russia, from the rights political in Austria, from the economic in Germany. The only way to oppose this is through a threefolding ascent, which is to say, having a fully conscious grasp on the idea of threefolding. And now we have to imagine that there is a territory that has to decide whether it wants to belong to those who are unable to really form a state, to Poland, or whether it should become a limb of that threefolded Europe that has brought together all the elements directing it toward downfall, Austria, Prussian, Germany, and Russia. In other words, it has to decide whether it will belong to one of these three limbs, in this case, to Germany. Such a decision must induce us to think about wherein the healing lies when we say, quote, "We are not concerned with what has come about in Europe. but we want to put into these moments of development precisely what must come anew. Close quote. It might be possible to speak cleverly and to show that everything that I have presented here today is not clever, but the conclusions that one would draw from this sort of talk will never lead us to a rational Europe. Therefore, it is necessary that we base ourselves on positive, real relationships. This is what I wanted to say to you today. The end of Lecture 11, which is Lecture 1 in Part 2 of the book. End of Lecture 11.